Good morning and welcome to KBOO Radio. This is KBOO 90.7. You're listening now to APA Compass, and this program is made possible to you in part by the KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Ambling Bear Distributor, which distributes and recycles free periodicals. Welcome to this month's edition of APA Compass, your Asian Pacific American orientation. In this month of May, we celebrate Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, a celebration of Asians and Pacific Islanders in the United States. May was chosen to commemorate the immigration of the first Japanese to the United States in May of 1843, and also to mark the anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in May of 1869. The majority of the workers who laid these tracks were Chinese immigrants. In today's show, we have an interview with Felicia Lowe, a pioneering documentary filmmaker and longtime board member of the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation. We have an interview and music from Dunn. He is a guitarist and the co-founder of the Village School Foundation. We also have a live roundtable discussion with local community organizations that work with the Asian Pacific Islander community here in Portland. Also, stay tuned for the community calendar and for this month's Angry Asian Minute. Stay tuned for all of that and more.
I'm Wes Wong for KBOO's Asian Pacific American Compass. Earlier this year, I caught up with Dunn, the organ-trained acoustic guitar virtuoso, at his Village School Foundation benefit concert. Dunn co-founded the Village School Foundation to build schools in rural Vietnam. Listening to his richly layered music, you may wonder if you're hearing one guitarist or two. It's just one. Anyone who has seen Dunn play live has witnessed his passion for music and also his passion for humanity and spreading a message of peace.
You know, the music I play is pretty much touch on the humanity base. And I have such a broad spectrum in my music, and so it touches everybody at a different level. And so after a concert, you know, like a certain song will hit somebody differently. And yeah, I've had, you know, some resistance from the Viet communities, and, you know, why are you doing this, and why are you bringing the war and the pain back? And just like with Hiroshima, I mean, it's a history that we all need to learn from. We all need to be remembers, and the people that passed away, you know, we need to learn the lessons from them. And I pretty much carry the message of peace, you know, and I hope that in the end, you know, no matter what race or religions or greed to anything that you come from, that you will understand, you know, we're all human beings, and, you know, we have compassion, you know, for one another.
Have you had resistance from white Americans? Similarly, why are you bringing up a chapter of history that's very difficult for us to go back to, or particularly among veterans who came back and weren't appreciated as the veterans of the previous generation were celebrated?
You know, even over 30 years, and there's our Americans, veterans that, you know, resist to what I have to say, because it's kind of open up, you know, the wounds that they have been carrying for 30 years. And what I do is encourage them, you know, to come to the show, because pretty much what I'm doing is trying to heal, you know, that wound where we all can relate at a totally different level. And so the resistance is sort of like a very, very personal thing. You know, there are Viet veterans also that have a really hard time. It's just, it's almost as if you go to a different planet or something and you start telling, you know, all your trouble, and people don't understand you at all, and they're just blank faces. After a few times, you realize you are very alone in sadness, and it's almost as if we're, you know, living inside that grief, but it's something that comforts us. So my music is just to bring a certain level of comfort to these people, and just kind of reach out to them that, you know, we're all the same, and hopefully we move on from there. Many nights I couldn't sleep, and I would be lying awake, and I was thinking if I ever get a chance to meet like a northern Vietnamese kid, I want to ask him, how's it feels? How does he feel? Does he hurt less if his father died in the war, but they won? And I was wondering, what's it like to ask like an American child that has his or her parents in the war, that his father or her father has been killed, if he or she hurts less? I went to do a show, and this man, in like, you know, his hair was all white, he's like in his 80s, and he walked up to me, and he just held me really close. And at first it was really off the sun, it was kind of strange, this big guy just came and just held me so tight. And then I realized, you know, he was shivering and shaking, he, you know, was crying, and he went, yeah, I think it was just last week that I finally found my inner peace, and you touched me.
I think a lot of America, in their minds, their musical recollection of what they call the Vietnam War, and Vietnam they call it American War, is more like Creedence Clearwater Revival or Marvin Gaye. You go back to your childhood, which is when that music was coming out. You left Vietnam when you were 12. How do you channel those early memories?
That's a really hard question, because it's been like a really long, you know, growing process. It's been 30 years, and you kind of live with those kind of memories just pretty much every day. And, you know, I have friends that they're just kind of amazed with the fact that I play the guitar, and they never really see me practice or walk around with the guitar or anything like that. And partly because when I'm on stage, it's pretty much like I'm sharing what I'm doing. It becomes something like I almost leave behind, because then I can't really relive these moments, you know, each and every day. It's just really a hard thing. And I'm just hoping that in the end, by reaching out to these people, you know, and we all have collective memories, and we all realize how as one we are, that, you know, some days the healing process, you know, will begin, and our memories be replaced with more beautiful memories of our children and our children's children, and so on.
before he came to the United States, he'd also lived in the Philippines and in Pakistan. How do experiences in Pakistan and Philippines, how does that show in what you play?
You know, having left Vietnam and pretty much for so many years, you pretty much lost your country and you cannot go back to it. And so every little tiny bit of another country that you can find, you know, something that relate to your childhood or something that relates so much of your past, you know, you kind of embrace these things and you grow on them so much more than a regular person would. And so when you go to a country like Pakistan and you get that culture and the passion, you know, and the loving, the family style of these people, and you embrace, you know, that part of it. And then you go to the Philippines and, you know, the people look almost like your people, you know, I mean, and, you know, the way they talk, the way they carry themselves, their cultures, and you, you know, kind of lean yourself against these things, you know. And I think one thing really great too is when you come to America, even though there's, you know, there's a lot of parts, I mean, we have a lot of diversity here, there are still, you know, little pockets here and there that you can find, you know, other Asian people. For some reason, you know, it makes you feel like, for moments when you sit there, you're home.
The Village School Foundation, which you helped create, why schools out of all the places that could be benefited from art, activism, and raising consciousness, why have you chosen schools?
I feel that there are just two ways a person can get out of poverty. One of them is to marry into somebody who's already rich, and the second one is to have a great education. When I came home and all I saw are these people, you know, with a lot of poverties, and we have met kids that are out on the streets, you know, orphans, no mama, no daddies, and they live just up the streets selling lottery tickets, and it's just kind of amazing. So I started talking with these kids and asking them, just beside your basic needs, you know, making money and help your family, you know, have food to eat, what do you really want? And each and every one of those kids will say, I would like to go to school. And so that really kind of tells me that this is really what the people need. And so there are so many things I can do. And this is pretty much like you help people to help themselves. And the education will last on for generations. You know, the schools that we build out there will forever be there. And so I just think it's such a great and powerful thing, you know, to give people this education.
If there's one thing you would like to pass on to Asian Americans, particularly the youth today, what would that be?
I would say to really embrace your culture, you know, listen to your parents, the elders that have been there, they've been experienced, and you see, you know, the differences between our people versus different other cultures. And that's one of the things amazing is that our elders, I mean, we just follow that one simple lesson. They listen to their wise words of wisdom, and that if we were to, you know, pay attention to all these things that these people have experienced and learned, and now that they're here, just follow that one simple rules. And I think we all have a great chance to become great and useful human beings. Part of the reason why I do what I do is because, you know, I don't want people to just think, you know, when they think of Vietnam, they think of the war, or now they think of, you know, a bowl of pho, or when they think of Korean, they think of just kimchi, or when they think of Japanese, they think of, you know, sushi kind of thing, and they identified us, you know, very into, like, kitty corners of way of thinking. And so when I do the kind of shows that I do, just really bring out the humanity in who we are as people, and these people will start to listen and eventually will see us as people.
More than a million people across the United States joined to protest anti-immigration legislation that would criminalize undocumented migrants, their families, and anyone who helped them. The anti-immigrant sentiments and rhetoric that have fueled recent legislative maneuverings are not new. In fact, they are remarkably similar to those that ushered in the 1882 Chinese Exclusion Act, the first in a series of racist immigration laws directed at immigrants of color. This 1882 Act was the first in U.S. history to restrict a group of immigrants based on race, nationality, and class, targeting Chinese laborers who were perceived as economic threats to white Americans. In 1924, virtually all immigrants from Asia were denied entry, and it was not until the mid-1940s that a tiny quota of Asian immigrants allowed in. From 1910 to 1940, immigrants who crossed the Pacific were detained at Angel Island Immigration Station, located in the San Francisco Bay. Ostensibly a processing center for immigrants, it was, in reality, a prison.
Angel Island and that story of the Chinese immigration and the exclusion laws was such a hidden chapter in American history. You know, my father never mentioned it, and that was a very common response to that history. I think it was a combination of shame, and that silence, though, really took away our understanding of what Angel Island was.
That was Felicia Lowe, longtime board member of the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation and award-winning documentary filmmaker. She talked to APA Compass about her films and how her search into Chinese American history intertwined with her search into her own family's history.
The trajectory of my work has really been a result of becoming a mother in some sense. I'd always been curious about the history of the Chinese in America simply because I grew up at a time when there was very little representation, either in print or in history. As I was going to school, I was brought up with the Dick and Jane readers, which, you know, represented blonde, blue-eyed people who had, you know, the perfect life. And it was a life that didn't reflect my own experience growing up in Oakland, Chinatown. Then later, of course, even on television, you never saw any representation outside of perhaps the occasional Hop Singh or Charlie Chan, who was very clever but was played by white people. So as an American-born Chinese, not being able to relate to what I was learning in school and then not really having any background about my connection or knowledge about China made me feel out of it. So I think that has been the main draw, and also kind of, you know, my son was 3 months old when my father died. I think that once I had someone to want to pass history on to, I realized how little I had to pass on.
This led Lo to China to meet her paternal grandmother. That visit was documented in the film China, Land of My Father, which was nominated for an Emmy in 1980. She followed that film with Carved in Silence, released in 1988, a documentary about the detention of Chinese immigrants on Angel Island. Unlike Ellis Island, which has come to symbolize the promise of the American dream and the U.S. as a nation of immigrants, Angel Island has a much darker history.
Angel Island Immigration Station, unlike Ellis Island, was the place where they enforced the Chinese Exclusion Act. So typically, if you were an immigrant coming through Ellis Island, you were processed within a day. At Angel Island, much more typical was a stay of weeks, months, and in some cases, even years. And the reason was that their job was to keep you out of the country if you were Chinese. And there were other races and nationalities who came through Angel Island. There were people crossing the Pacific from Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia. We actually have documentation of Russians who had come through, who went to Siberia and then eventually to Shanghai and then came through, and I recently discovered that one of the reasons why they would take such a circuitous route was that visas were not required in some of those places, so they could finally get to the States. But the main and I think most dramatic story about Angel Island was its role in terms of processing the Chinese. And the point of making a film was really to look at how it felt what was the consequence of institutionalized racism? How does that affect people? You know, it really looked at who has the power to exclude and what does that mean? And finally, what was the legacy of that experience? And as a person who was a descendant of an Angel Island detainee, I would later find out that my father had been through Angel Island and was detained there for three weeks. And I had a grandfather who actually was held at Angel Island for a period of time. All of these documents are available at the National Archives locally in San Bruno. That ironic that it was the exclusion laws that kept them out, but at the same time it kept records, and that's what I'm able to access to learn about my own family.
In 1997, Lo received a Northern California Emmy for her documentary about San Francisco's Chinatown. Her current project moves beyond the U.S. to examine the Chinese in Cuba, again connecting family history into the larger context of the Chinese diaspora.
The reason why I came to the current film that I'm making initially was called El Barrio Chino, and now it's called A Chinese Couplet, is actually kind of closing a circle of my own kind of personal journey that has coincided with many other people of my generation and our experience with immigration and our parents not talking about it. I mentioned that my mother also spoke very little about her life. One of the things that she never mentioned but revealed to my daughter was that I had a grandfather, her father, left for Cuba before she was born and stayed there for 15 years. And it was shocking to me on many levels. One is that I'd never heard about the Chinese in Cuba. And secondly, it was a giant piece of information in terms of understanding who she was. Because when I would ask her about it, she still had very harsh feelings towards her father. Her feelings were that he had abandoned the family. And that, you know, her mother, my grandmother, that had to fend for her and her sister during a time that was very difficult in China. There was a lot of political turmoil and there was a lot of economic hardship. But it was also something that just drove me crazy in the sense that she still felt, even as at that time a woman in her 70s, so much pain and anger at this man. And I just thought it would really maybe be helpful for me to find out, one, what was he doing in Cuba? And was there possibly another family there that he had started? And also, I was curious for my mother. So I took a trip to Cuba. I've done it twice now. Cuba has been taking in Chinese immigrants since the 1850s, much like the United States. They went there to work as coolie laborers as they did in the United States. And then during World War One in the 1920s, they relaxed their immigration status and allowed Chinese to go there again. Again, they needed workers, and the Chinese filled that gap. A third wave of Chinese went to Cuba in 1949 during the revolution in China. And then, of course, 10 years later, Cuba had its own revolution. So those Chinese who had moved there 10 years earlier, those who could leave left, and those who couldn't stayed. And they are kind of the mainstays, the pure Chinese who are there now, who are now people in their mid-60s and actually more in their 70s and who had raised families, often come from that wave of immigrants who arrived in Cuba. What's interesting is that they are trying to revitalize their Chinatown, which was once the most bustling, vital Chinatown in all of Latin America at one time. This one not only deals with the aspect of the Chinese in Cuba, but it takes a much broader look at what motivates, what are the geopolitical forces that create the movements of people. I think it's taken me this long in my life to be able to take more of a bird's eye view of looking down at the situation and saying, what caused my grandfather to go to Cuba? What caused my mother to come to America? What was going on in China at that time? What was going on in Cuba at that time? What was going on in the United States that they could then leave China to go to the United States? And what were the circumstances? So I'm looking at including that kind of view, that kind of context to the story. And it helps me now appreciate why perhaps they were so silent. Even when I was born, actually, I also had a different name on my birth certificate. And when I was six, my father changed the name to Lowe, which is his real family name. Mother, in her lifetime, had six different names. And she used to say to me, you know, if anybody asked, say I was born in Hawaii, when I knew she was born in China, and it was all very confusing. And so I have to say that it's been kind of untangling these kinds of half-truths and untruths. I don't even know if my parents could have particularly articulated it for me in a way in which I could have understood as a young child. But now I feel like I can put some of these puzzle pieces together to form a picture. There are some missing pieces, and I'm finally comfortable not understanding that I can't possibly get all the puzzle pieces. But I think the result will be something that hopefully helps people understand the motivation for Chinese diaspora in general. And what specifically happened to the Chinese, of course, has happened to all other groups of people. I think finally, you know, the stories in the end are all about how people survive, you know, and I find them to be triumphant. But it's triumphant because there was hardship along the way, and until we can even acknowledge what that hardship was, you know, we can't get past it. So it's been important to kind of lay it out, not blaming or any of that stuff, but just to say, hey, you know, this has been a part of our history too.
In demonstrating how personal history is shaped by collective history, Lowe's work is a reminder of how important it is for our communities to join in the struggle against this new wave of unjust immigration laws. To pay tribute to the struggles of the early generation of Asian immigrants, we must not forget their stories, nor allow new racist immigration laws to divide us.
Hi, this is Patty Sakurai with APA Compass, and we're very pleased to have a panel of local community activists, organizers, folks from the community. Before we get to that, though, just to let you know, at 10 o'clock, the guest is David Smith, co-editor of Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. At 10:30 on Sounds of Awareness, host Paul Van Dyke speaks with Chris Cook, the first and only blind person who has ever become a naturopathic physician. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, topics include the death of legendary peace activist Damien Smith and the challenging of President Bush by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. But now we're going to turn to our live panel. We just listened to a piece, an interview with filmmaker Felicia Lowe, talking about some of her family history and the broader immigration history, Asian migrations, and what we hope to do with this live panel is to turn to the more contemporary situation, some of the issues that face our communities and the kind of challenges that work kind of entails. But first we'll go around the room and have each of you introduce yourselves and say a little bit about yourselves.
Good morning. My name is Pooja Kishore, and I'm a student at PCC, and I'm affiliated with the Multicultural Center on campus, and I have been for a couple of years now.
And my name is Colleen Kim. Good morning. I work with the API community, the Asian Pacific Islander communities, with their families and youth, and that's what I do professionally.
Hi, my name is Roselle. I am a junior student at Portland State University, and I'm with a student group called Kaibigan, which is the Filipino-American Student Association at Portland State.
Hi, I'm Victor Leo. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in Portland, Oregon. I also produce a radio program on Sunday night once a month with the environment, East, West. So I'll be on the air this Sunday at 8 p.m.
Great. Well, thank you so much, all of you, for agreeing to do this and being here with us. We'll have some discussion to let you know. We will be taking some calls later on in a few moments. That's 503-231-8187. But first, I wanted to ask folks here what they see in their work or experiences as issues that are emerging in the Asian Pacific American communities. You know, what are some of the more pressing issues that you've seen?
Well, it just depends on our area of contact or expertise. As a social worker, I deal with mental health counseling, and I'm kind of interested in addictive behavior. So we're talking about substance abuse and like gambling and those things. My perspective is one of the major issues in our communities are the denial of the issues. We don't think that we ever have any problem with drinking, with gambling, but it is there.
I'd have to totally agree with you, Victor. Mm-hmm. There totally is a lack of culturally specific services for especially API youth, especially when it comes to drug services and mental health services. It seems like out there in our communities, they've identified that it's not really a pertinent problem that affects us, but it does. It's just not as visible. So the need for those services is so vital, but there's just a lack of accessing those services.
Pooja?
I certainly feel, to a certain extent, there's a divide within the communities itself, within Asian and Pacific Islander communities. Like often, I'm an Indian woman, and often Indians aren't really considered to be Asians, which we are. So there's a divide, I feel, and there's a way to get together.
I totally agree with Pooja. I think that also, like, talking about division, I think that within the API communities, I would, like, specifically in the Filipino community that I am a part of, I think that there's a great disconnection between the elderly and the youth, just because, like, we may stand on something that they don't agree with, and I think that most of it is, you know, it could be the ageism in the community, and I know, and I've been a part of the youth group right now that have experienced that in the past.
Yeah, definitely. And kind of thinking about some of these issues then, I'm wondering if you had some thoughts or would like to share some of your strategies or approaches for addressing some of these issues, what you might like to see happen. How do we bridge that divide in terms of generations? How do we do outreach and raise awareness and kind of push through some of those barriers in terms of services for communities that I think are often seen as, well, they don't have any problem. Get back to the model minority. No problems there, and so forth. So anyone?
Oh, do we have any problem in the Asian community? No, we're the model minority. No, to be true, I think you hit a real good point in the 60s, and there are a lot of articles talking about Asian as model minority, but I guess we need to really move away from that pride and go into the reality. Denial is one thing, and talking about the generation gap is, I see that in my Chinese community also. I have run into so many, even the 50-some-year-old father who say, I'm not going to take care of my father, he's too old. Mm-hmm. And it's away from the old time where we are in China, that everybody in one under one roof, under one household, and everybody take care of each other. Nowadays in United States, we don't see those things. And it really become a issue in reaching out to the other, because you're talking to only a segment of people. If I talk to you, I'm talking to the youth segment. If I go talk to him, I'll be talking to the middle-aged segment. And you don't really go to the whole community. The communication, partly is language, partly is culture. It really limits how far our message can go. And Peter, I heard you ask earlier about how do we go about doing our outreaching and those things. For a long time, my strategy is to try to influence the older folks with the younger folks, because they're the ones that are educating here, take on the idea, the culture, and the messages we want the other people in the community to hear. But yes, it is kind of limited. It works in some sense, but sometimes, like I said, it really stopped in the youth culture, stopped in the youth community. It didn't go too far.
So I was in this conversation with the elderly Filipinos in my community, and like one time we were talking about organizing, and one elderly said that, you know, like in his experience, the youth are really, like, when you let them do whatever they want to do, like they really messed up big time. So he said that he thinks that the youth can totally organize, but they need an elderly person directing them or kind of advising them. So we really see that this is really a big problem, because we feel that we can make a difference. So what I do in my student group at Portland State, which is the Filipino American Student Association, every term we host 3 to 5 workshops dealing with these issues. And recently, like last month, we just hosted a conference that attracted 400 Filipino youths in the Northwest. And what we did is we brought one elderly, and he led a workshop on the misconstrued Filipino values. And it's really interesting, because you see a lot of students going to his workshop, asking him about questions, about, you know, like the things that they're really confused with. They said, yeah, my parents think that I have to be a doctor and stuff like that. And they just really explained it really well. So I think that it's really good to have an ally in the elderly community telling you something different from what other people are telling you.
For me, bridging the gap means to stop marginalizing the API community, because I understand, like, API is this great catch-all phrase for all Asian and Pacific Islanders, but we really need to recognize that there are differences within that larger group. Like, for example, PIs don't consider, not necessarily all of them consider themselves as Asians, and then vice versa. And then within the Asian community, a lot of the mainstream they're not educated about all the differences within that Southeast Asian, Northern Asian, South Asian, and all the cultural differences. So for me, it kind of needs to start on top with public institutions and private institutions to basically have that recognition, to be educated about, like, that we're not just all clumped into one group, and to stereotype us all as one group who have these traits, but to recognize that this is basically a big collective with so many different differences. And then also to identify that, you know, as our histories here grow stronger and progress, that we're bicultural people. I mean, we're Asian and Pacific Islander Americans who, you know, just are acting and want to live just like any other, you know, American citizen here. So just to identify that we do share the same problems, we do experience the same upbringings, we want to belong, we want to be accepted. So kind of that, for me, is like bridging the gap. And then I hope that, like, that's reflected in, for me, the work that I do is to, you know, do those cultural trainings, to outreach, to kind of educate education providers and, you know, all the other people I work with. So.
Great. Yeah, and we do have a caller, but before we take that call, Pooja, I want to give you a chance if you had some thoughts on that.
Oh, I agree, Colin. You brought up a really good point, because we are. I mean, there is... For me, I'm an immigrant, you know, from India, so that brings up a lot of sentiment with me, as I do have a really strong connection to my culture back home, and then, you know, have, you know, my life here, and with going back to what Russell said with the elderly, there is a lot of pressure as, you know, an Asian, and then there's the pressure as an American, so. It's kind of it's a really loaded issue, and it's a very sentimental issue for a lot of us, I think, and just finding something in between. And to find communities that we can relate to, like FASA for you and Kaibigan. You know, just build communities in our own like that, I think, is really important.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we have a caller, Alma.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for calling in. You had a comment or question?
Yes, I do. I read the Asian Reporter religiously and keep up with things. And I have a comment. Last year I went to the fair that I believe is going to be May 20th out at the convention center, mm-hmm. the Asian American Fair, and I was horrified to see the sponsors as every gambling casino, every car salesman, every insurance company, and every bank. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any businesses. I didn't see any community services. I mean, I was horrified. Mm-hmm. These and also the U.S. Navy sponsors this. Now, I would like to know why this is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
If you do have a gambling problem, keep the casinos from sponsoring all your events. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have to take your money where you can find it. I understand that. But mm-hmm. when it was in such huge preponderance, mm-hmm. I came there expecting to see an exchange of, you know, cultural information mm-hmm. and all kinds of neat things. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Also, a while back I read, again, the Asian Reporter is a wonderful paper, where services to the Asian community at the federal level were taken out of the Health and Human Services Department
mm-hmm.
and put into the Commerce Department.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the outcry against that?
Mm-hmm.
And I will take any answers you have off the air.
Yeah, well, definitely. And I think, you know, for me personally, and this is Patty, you know, it raises the issue, too, when we talk about community, of whom are we speaking, and thinking about, you know, who does the organizing for a particular event, how representative are they of the interests of the community, and kind of those issues around sponsorship and so forth. But if any of the panelists wanted to respond to that issue as well.
Oh, so I'll just
money.
money, but
really
you know, we are, everybody does. It's like the zoo taking money from Weyerhaeuser to sponsor an event focusing on you know, endangered species when it was Weyerhaeuser that cut down all their forests that they lived in.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's unconscionable to take money from casinos when your people have a gambling problem. So anyhow. I just thought I'd throw that in if you think it's something that should be discussed, or I would like somebody else, you know, somebody's opinion on it or whatever, or what can be done to involve the community so that they would actually show up and do some stuff at these things.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay, yeah. And Pooja, you wanted to comment?
For one, I'd like to address that was just an issue. I don't think it's an issue that that involves the entire community, but it is an issue in the API community just like it is in any other community. So I do want to address that, but money, you know, money does talk, I think is what Victor was kind of saying as well, but it's resources to run anything are really, really, really hard to get around or to get to, pardon me, and if it is the banks and the casinos and, you know, in order to even organize, if it is those organizations that do provide money, in order to even put up these, you know, events, the money is going to trickle in from there. And it's not that money can't be found from small business. It's just the small businesses are struggling to stay open themselves, so we're not really going to get as much help from a lot of the nonprofit or the private organizations that we would love to primarily support.
Well, Kipu just finished his press drive, and I hope you all, after you hear Elmer's concern, support Kipu more than ever before. The reason Kipu can be a listener support station is because our funding comes from listeners, and we do not have to depend on casino to support us. You bring a very good point. I'm sure there are people, actually I know there are people in our Asian community who are resisting to tobacco company funding, alcohol funding, and all those things. But a lot of the time it's reality. They are the ones that can put up big bucks and if you want to have a successful event, you need money, and they're the one that you can approach. Listener support is always good.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, I would like to add something in relation to what the lady said as far as the absence of the Asian community in those kinds of events. And I think it all goes back to the disconnection between the community, whether you identify with, I don't know, Asian or Pacific Islander community, just because I think that, like, for me as a Filipino, whenever we say Asian, like I had one person tell me before, you don't look Asian just because I don't look Chinese or Vietnamese mm-hmm. or Korean, which mm-hmm. are really the famous whatever picture of like the Asian community. I think it all goes to that really in the end.
Okay, call in just real quick. The number again is 503-231-8187. We have just a few minutes left if you want to call. That's all. Colleen?
Yeah, I have to. Your point is very valid, and you know I appreciate the comment. So it is really unfortunate that corporate sponsors kind of have out-prioritized what we fundamentally think is important to be represented at those type of fairs or events. But kind of like what everyone else is saying, it's kind of driven by that corporate dollar and who can put up the most money. So that's what you're going to kind of see in those events. In exchange for those corporate sponsors, you're going to see more visibility of those, you know, multi-billion dollar corporations. And you know, with the smaller community providers and health service providers and all that, they actually are there. They're just not as visible. So that's kind mm-hmm. of represented as who can put up the most money is actually more visible. So you just kind of have to look for them. But they are there because they want to be there and they want to provide the right message.
Yeah. Well, and so we have just a couple of minutes left. But speaking on the issue of funding, we had another kind of thought or question that we want to throw out to you all around the issue of funding. And I think often groups at least feel like they're kind of competing against each other for funding, and what your thoughts on how to, you know, how you strategize to avoid that, not just competing with other community organizations that serve API community groups, but also beyond that in terms of other communities of color, other underserved populations. You know, it's just such a pitfall. So.
Well, I guess resources always limited. From my perspective, working in social work field for 30 years, I like for all the social service providers in Portland to really strategize on who would support what kind of service, who would provide what service to who. And so we can have a collective of agencies providing services.
Great. Actually, and I think we actually have a quick call. So go ahead, caller.
Oh, hi, is that me?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Yeah, thanks. Great. It's kind of about the comment that the person just made, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a social work intern at Cascadia,
uh-huh.
and I was thinking two things. One is that if you do have a community event, it would be great to invite Cascadia or perhaps some mental health services that are specifically working with the Asian population to bring some brochures to the event.
Mm-hmm.
To do that kind of outreach. So, you know, you will have to have the expensive gambling sponsors, perhaps, you know, maybe. Mm. But then you can also bring in the community mental health services. And the second thing is we need to be doing a better job of outreach.
Yeah, definitely. So we have about a half a minute left. Any responses to that or reiterations or final thoughts?
I agree with that. Mental health services need to be known to the community more than what it is at this time.
Yeah.
Definitely. Just that if you are out there and you are going to these events, just look in those corners, look in those little spots where you don't think anyone's there, because they actually are, and they're there to represent, and they're there to provide, you know, just great information.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much again for being here, sharing your thoughts and insights and experiences with us. We really appreciate it. And thank you to those who called in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For this month's Asian Pacific American Community Calendar, later today, it's Dance Around the World at Portland State University. This event will take place at 7 p.m., located at Native American Student and Community Center at 701 Southwest Jackson Street. Enjoy dance performances representing cultures around the world at a benefit event for the Multiracial Family Center. Among the performers will be members of the Vietnamese Students Association, Filipino Student Organization, and Pacific Islanders Club. On May 7th from 12:30 to 4:30, celebrate Children's Day at Portland Japanese Gardens annual event. For information, call 503-223-1321 or visit JapaneseGarden.com. Redwood Curtain is a play about a 17-year-old piano prodigy who is a biracial adopted daughter of one of the nation's wealthiest families. One of the few plays written by a U.S. playwright with an Asian-American female as the lead character. It is being shown through May 14th at Theater Theater, located at 3430 Southeast Belmont. Oregon poet laureate Lawson Inada will be at Oregon State University on May 11th at 4 p.m. in Weatherford Hall, room EG01. Asia Fest is on May 20th this year and will be located at the Oregon Convention Center. The goal of this event is to bring all Asian communities together and create celebrations that represent the diversity of all of our cultures. Also, right here on KBOO, every Sunday from 7 to 9 p.m., listeners can hear other APA programs. Also, every second and third Tuesday afternoon, tune in to hear music from the Pacific Islands.
And now, here's Toyomi Yoshida with the Angry Asian Minute.
It's never been okay for me to be who I am. I am an immigrant, a queer person, a person of color, and a genderqueer. Oftentimes I feel like the tiny overlap section of a Venn diagram. When the communities I belong to fight and pull away from each other, they don't realize that they've torn me up to a point where I no longer exist. That's how it is right now. People go out of their way to ignore me. Occasionally, when I have the energy, I force myself in, and they tell me that I'm selfish. When people talk about sexism, it's about white women. It doesn't include Asian people or immigrants. When people talk about heterosexism, it doesn't include queer people of color or immigrants either. And recently, I've been noticing that when people talk about immigrant rights, gay immigrant issues are the least of their priorities. I'm going to be frank with you and say that that is very silly. I can assure you that we are going to hit a dead end if you continue to refuse to be inclusive. For the millionth time, inviting two people who are different from you is not inclusive. None of us are free until all of us are free. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? But when are we going to start taking it seriously? How do you expect to bring justice when you're leaving people behind? I say it's silly because even if your community stops suffering for a moment, in no time, the oppression will come right back. I no longer trust white people who only talk about white privilege. It's like fundamentalist Christians saying Jesus this, Jesus that. The outcome is the same, and I am tired of everyone pretending to be inclusive. When I talk like this, people think I'm crazy. I don't mind that at all. I want to be hated, criticized, ridiculed. Call me crazy.
Thank you for tuning in to APA Compass. For questions or more information on the collective, you can visit us at www.apacompass.org or email us at apacompass@gmail.com. The APA Compass Collective would like to thank those who contributed to today's program, our panelists Pooja, Rosella, Colleen, and Victor, and interviewees Felicia Lowe and Dunn. Today's program was produced by the APA Compass Collective, executive producer Liz Rogers, and engineered by Wes Wong and Pam Fon. Please tune in every first Friday of the month from 9 to 10 a.m. for APA Compass, an Asian Pacific American public affairs program.
Today we close APA Compass with a live recording from guitarist activist Dunn at his Village School Foundation benefit concert. To see pictures of the schools built in rural Vietnam by the Village School Foundation, and for more information on how to support the organization, go to the website at vsfoundation.com.
The first village school that the Village School Foundation built was the spring of 2005. Since then, we have built two more schools. Our goal is to build two more, and we would have five schools running. And the most ironic part about the first school for me is that this school was built on an old American Army base. But when you go there, you're not going to see any men in uniform. You're not going to see helicopters. You're not going to see your guns and tanks and bombs, and you're not going to hear any sounds of gunfire. Instead of those sights and sound, when you go there, you're going to see children in their school uniform, laughing, learning. The first time I went to see the school, I just cried. But it's so different than all the other times I've cried, because my tears didn't flow outward. It's kind of flow inward. And it mixed into my bloodstreams, and it went all over my body. And within seconds, it reached my heart. And all of a sudden, I felt this just the most incredible happiness and satisfaction. I was wondering to myself, is this nirvana? Is this enlightenment? Is this the grace of God? Or is this healing? And if this is healing, how many schools should I help build before I feel whole again? And one day on my deathbed, my son would ask me, Daddy, how do you heal a wounded heart? I would answer him in three little words. Faitute, which means with kindness. This piece is called To Heal the Wounded Hearts.